The root of the border dispute between originally Bolivia and Chile is similar to many former colonial possessions. The delineation between the province of Chile under the Spanish Empire and the Audiencia de Charcas, that's the area that would become Bolivia, was left intentionally vague, or maybe accidentally vague, simply because it was all part of the same empire. There was no real desperate need to demarcate or even explain where the borders were, since it would always be a higher authority to appeal to in the case of a dispute. Now, in the case of the border between what would become Bolivia and Chile, it was particularly unimportant to demarcate the border because it ran somewhere through the Atacama Desert. The Atacama is probably the most desolate part of the planet, unlike, say, the Mojave Desert in California or the Sahara, which comparatively teem with life. The Atacama is virtually sterile. There's something about the topography of the area that does not allow rain to fall ever, literally for centuries at a time. So there's essentially no life there at all, which made it very unattractive. So whether the border was a mile or two or three north or south really didn't appear to matter at the time. Now, that situation pertained certainly until the time of independence in the early 1800s. And even then, in the Chilean Constitution, the border was very vaguely described in the north as running from the Atacama Desert or in the Atacama Desert south to Tierra del Fuego. No coordinates given, no longitude, latitude, anything like that in the Chilean Constitution. But it was generally understood that the southern border of Bolivian territory, what would become Bolivian territory, ran inland from the sea at 25 degrees 36 seconds south. There are actually designations in Spanish documents that would actually put the line even farther south at 27 degrees, giving Bolivia rather more territory. But it was generally conceded that Bolivia, or the Audiencia de Charcas, was entitled to about 400 or 500 miles of coastline between Peru and Chile. Again, it was very desolate territory, so nobody really cared that much. Now, after independence, the Chilean government turned out to be rather more aggressive than the Bolivian, and a succession of Chilean presidents began to push the border farther and farther north, at least in their statements. Now, one of the things that, sort of the tragedy for Bolivia, was the demographics of the area. Chile is not unlike the United States or Argentina next door, was populated largely by European immigrants. The indigenous population was either exterminated by disease or warfare or driven far, far to the south, whereas Bolivia and Peru also had huge indigenous population, a huge majority left over from the Incan Empire. The Chilean population was very aggressive and relatively mobile, whereas the bulk of the Bolivian population tended to be very sedentary and concentrated up in the Altiplano, in the area around La Paz, Potosí, and Cochabamba. The idea of getting Bolivians to migrate down to populate this coastal strip just didn't ever really catch on. The Chileans, on the other hand, particularly in the 19th century, were going through a process similar to much of the rest of the world, where thousands of people were being driven off the land by modernization and rationalization of agriculture to look for work in cities and elsewhere. And these Chilean rotos, they're called broken men, drifted not only in Chile, but up and down the coast looking for work. So thousands of Chileans emigrated to this part of Bolivia and also up into Peru looking for employment. When the war broke out, it was a little awkward that it turned out about a third of the Peruvian Navy, but a third of the sailors were actually Chileans, and they had to be replaced, obviously. In the Atacama, again, this issue might not ever have come to a head had it not been for two of the circumstance, a combination of an advance in technology and the topography I already mentioned. It never rains in the Atacama. However, the waters are off the Chilean and Bolivian and Peruvian coasts are extremely rich in marine life because of the Humboldt Current. Consequently, hordes of seabirds have made their homes for centuries along the coast. And to sort of paraphrase the popular bumper sticker, bird guano happens. And since there's never any rain to wash it away, over the centuries and centuries, it has built up to a depth of tens of meters. Well, apart from being unpleasant, that would not have been particularly important, except that in the late 1800s, there was a sudden boom in the interest of nitrates, both for, no pun intended, explosives and for fertilizer. It turns out that bird guano is very rich in nitrates. So all of a sudden, the territory went from being absolutely worthless to being tremendously valuable. And unfortunately for Bolivia, there was nothing any Bolivian government could do to convince either Bolivian citizens to move to the area to begin to exploit this wealth, or even Bolivian capital to move to the area. Bolivia did have rather wealthy families, the Patiños, or the tin mining dynasty, but they were busy with their own things, and there was never any serious investment that would have really tied the coastal region to the Bolivian heartland. No railroads, no highways. It's a very tenuous sort of a mule track leading down from the Altiplano to the port of Antofagasta. The Chileans, on the other hand, were very ambitious in both moving their people and the capital into the area to develop this wealth. And the Chilean government basically followed trade. As Chilean investment became more intense in the Atacama, the Chilean government began to expand its claims of territory from 27 degrees south to 25, to 23, to 21, still leaving Bolivia with something of a coastal area, but gradually encroaching. This led to tension over the years in the mid-1800s. But no outright conflict. What sparked the war itself, which is why it's sometimes referred to as the 10 cents war, was the fact that the Bolivian government had made an agreement with Chile, in part to attract the foreign capital to develop the region, not to tax exports of Chilean companies from the area, or to tax them at a very, very low level. Well, the town of Antofagasta, which is a very minor little port, the municipal government of Antofagasta decided that it needed just a little bit of funding to provide amenities like street lamps and paving for the streets as opposed to mud roads. And the local government decided to put a tax of 10 centavos on every quintal, a large sack, of guano that was exported, of nitrates exported out of Antofagasta. The amount of money involved was minuscule. However, the Chilean entrepreneurs protested. They didn't want to pay even that much money, even though they would be the beneficiaries of the improvements. Then the Chilean government took up their cause. The Bolivian government chose to stand on nationalist principles. Of course, the Chilean government was a stable, democratically elected government. The Bolivian was almost the exact opposite, an endless succession of palace revolutions and very tenuously held presidencies by men like the president during much of the war, Daza, who kept power only through force and could not be seen to be showing any element of weakness. In fact, the Bolivians refused to back down on the tax, gave the Chileans pretext for essentially launching invasion. Now, the war ended up including Peru as well, because Peru and Bolivia had executed a secret treaty of defense. Now, by secret, I use the Washingtonian term, meaning everybody knew about it. And Peru was faced with a very aggressive and rising power in Chile, and the only potential ally that the Peruvians could identify was Bolivia. The Peruvian government realized that if they backed down, if they failed to support Bolivia in what seemed to be a righteous cause, defending its own territory against invasion, not only would they lose their ally, but Bolivia would probably end up having to switch sides and support Chile in its own defense. and Peru would be definitely left out in the cold. So even though Peru itself had no immediate interest in the conflict, Peru was dragged into the fighting almost immediately. The war began as a naval war in which the superior Chilean Navy, possessed of two very modern ironclads made in, built in Britain, crushed the Peruvian Navy despite very energetic and even ingenious tactics by the Peruvian admirals. But once the Chileans had the control of the sea, it was a simple matter for the Chileans to simply launch a series of amphibious end runs around any defensive position the Allied forces, the Bolivians and Peruvians, tried to establish. By the time the Bolivian army, which was underpaid, poorly trained, and mainly experienced in overthrowing its own government, by the time they showed up on the coast, the Peruvian army was already in the field, and both of them were soundly defeated by the Chileans in a series of engagements. The Bolivian president, Daza, disgraced his own nation by giving just vociferous support to the war and promising all sorts of martial and warlike activities, and then essentially chickening out at the last minute, trying to withdraw his army, abandoning the Peruvian allies, who were only there to back up the Bolivians, and a small Bolivian force that had already been on the field. And his own officers found that so distasteful that Daza was overthrown, and the Bolivian army ended up supporting the Allied forces after all, to no avail. They were defeated. Now, once the war had gotten going, the Chilean government chose to expand their demands. Originally, they had wanted just a portion of the Bolivian coastline. Well, now, with virtually no resistance, they'd occupied all of it, and so they chose to keep that. But the southern Peruvian provinces of Tacna and Arica were also rich in nitrates. And since Peru was in the war, Chile decided to award itself reparations in the form of Peruvian territory. The war carried on. The Bolivians essentially dropped out of the conflict, although they did not make peace. They just stopped participating in the actual fighting. And the Chilean army, again, using amphibious assaults, moved farther and farther up the coast, crushing one Peruvian army after another, until finally they landed near Callao and marched on Lima itself, and eventually captured the city. The war itself dragged on for another several years of essentially guerrilla warfare. The Chileans really couldn't occupy all of Peru. The Peruvian population was rather substantial, and the Chilean army wasn't that large. So the Chileans set up a series of puppet governments to try and create essentially a civil war in Peru to support their own cause. The United States and other foreign powers made certain efforts to try and negotiate a settlement, the United States probably more than most, but the instability of the government in Peru and the intransigence of the government in Bolivia prevented any kind of an agreement from being reached until well into the 1880s. The final peace treaty ended up with Chile in possession of the entire Bolivian coast and the provinces of Tacna and Arica that had been Peruvian. That in itself is the crux of the problem we have today in coming up with some kind of a solution. Obviously for Bolivia, which is now landlocked, the overriding goal is to get access to the sea. This has been a policy of every Bolivian government. There have been many, many, many of them since the late 1800s. And even though there are various protocols with Chile and Peru both allowing free passage of Bolivian goods from their ports inland as a matter of national prestige, the Bolivian government has always wanted access to the sea. Well, the Chilean governments over the years have been amenable to that idea. The idea of creating a corridor of Bolivian territory to separate Peru and Chile is actually rather attractive to Chile. during the Cold War especially, Peru became not exactly a client of the Soviet Union, but they got rather substantial amounts of arms from the Soviet Union, while, of course, the Chileans depended on the United States and other Western countries for their weapons. And then during the 70s, after the fall of the Allende government and the sort of pariah government of Pinochet, virtually cut off the supply of Western arms for Chile, that was a matter of great concern for the Chileans. So Peru had a larger population, a rather substantial military force, well-armed, and an axe to grind. So putting a strip of neutral territory between the two countries would have been very, very attractive to the Chileans. The problem is that every time this is talked about with the Bolivians, who are amenable to the idea, negotiations, of course, were focused on the width of the corridor and that sort of thing, and what towns would actually be included, the Peruvians naturally objected. They pointed out that a strip of territory along the current Peruvian-Chilean border, even though all the territory given would be on the from the Chilean side of the line, was originally Peruvian territory. And the Peruvian governments would naturally say, if Chile is willing to give up that territory, they should give it back to the people it belonged to, which is Peru. Now, if they want to give back all Peruvian territory, Tacna and Arica, and then give a strip of territory to Bolivia as access to the sea, that's different. But, of course, the Chileans had no intention of giving up large tracts of territory for that sort of purpose. There seems to be very little chance that, in the long run, any kind of an agreement will ever be breached on this issue. Now, it's a matter of national prestige. In Bolivia, for example, every year they have an annual March to the Sea demonstration. They don't actually march to the sea, they just march around the town in La Paz, because people tend to like to march downhill as opposed to uphill. They're actually marching away from the sea most of the time. Still, it is a part of the platform of every Bolivian party that sovereign action of the sea will be a goal of their government. So there is always going to be a potential for conflict. On the other hand, in the nearly a century and a half since the end of the war, there has been no repeat of any violent activity. It seems very unlikely that any of the participants are going to go to war again to try and rectify the situation, but it's something that's going to rankle permanently. As much talk as there might be as for proposals for like gas for the sea, that Bolivians would provide Chile with natural gas in exchange for access to the sea, still runs into the problem of where the territory is going to lie. And unless somebody were to come up with the idea of a truncated Chile with a Bolivian corridor running through the middle of Chilean territory, Peru will continue to be drawn into the conflict or into the dispute. And no Peruvian party, I can't imagine, would ever be able to stomach the idea of Peru, what had been Peruvian territory, in which Peruvians consider to be legitimately there still, being given to a third party, Bolivia. So the chances for a resolution of the conflict are virtually nil. The UN and international law, as a matter of sort of personal prejudice, I guess, I have to say that since the UN has, I can't think of itself, essentially no international disputes ever, seems very unlikely to be able to solve this one. And international law really just doesn't come into play. The national interests are the only interests that are going to have an effect, and they're just incompatible. Peru would want all of its territory back. Bolivia wants access to the sea. Chile is not going to give back Tacna and Arica. And there's no perceptible pressure to make any of those parties change their position. Short of that, any good offices or well-meant intentions of the UN or any other international body are just superfluous.